And now for something completely different.
Forget everything you've been told by others before. Get ready for the real deal. The full story. The whole enchilada. It's the Lance Roberts Show. Presented by Clarity Financial. It's life, money, and sweat equity. Now, welcome in to the Lance Roberts Show.
And welcome to today's show. It is 3 o'clock here, Central Standard Time, and the markets are closing as we speak right now. And here's the important thing. Now, it's going to take just a couple of minutes for everything to kind of settle out here very shortly, but the S&P right now up about 5.5 points, the NASDAQ up 21 for the day. And that breaks a five-day losing streak, really, for the markets last week. Here's the chart right now that's really kind of important for us to be looking at. And potentially what we're doing in portfolios here over the next few days. About 2 weeks ago, the markets actually broke out to all-time highs. And we talked about then that this breakout to all-time highs was important because, well, this actually established that the bull market was still intact and that the allocation increases that we had been doing ever since the March and April lows had been the right thing to do. Of course, with this breakout, by the time the markets break out, the markets get extremely overbought on a short-term basis. So when you get this initial breakout, you always get this little initial surge of buyers because they're all excited that the market's breaking out to all-time highs. You know, roar of the crowds, whole nine yards, Serena Williams, whole bit. So the markets rally up here. We said, hey, be a little careful here because we're moving into the month of September. We've had two very strong months, July and August, and it's very likely we're going to see this market relax here a bit and give us a better opportunity to put some capital to work. Now, over the last weekend, we talked about the fact that this pullback to these previous breakout highs is actually a very bullish sign temporarily for the markets. In fact, tomorrow's technically speaking update is talking about 3,000 or bust on the S&P. The point here is that right now, bullish optimism is still very high. You take a look at confidence indicators, you take a look at momentum. Everything points to the fact that investors and traders want to keep pushing this market up in the short term. That's fine. No problem at all. Again, portfolios are allocated here. We're adding some exposure right here in some selected areas that we like exposure to. We had added mid-cap and small-cap earlier this year. That's been performing very well as of late. The one thing that we have been devoid of, and one thing we've talked about here on the show numerous times, is the fact that we still don't maintain any equity exposure to international portfolios simply because there's not really been any reason to own emerging markets or international funds as the performance there has been very lackluster. They're in a bearish trend right now, and there's really no evidence that it's time to add international equity exposure. So currently, we're continuing to overweight domestic portfolios and keep money invested domestically because really, well, that's where the momentum is. That's where action's happening. And, you know, the thing with portfolios is we want our money to be working, not waiting for something to play catch up and get back to even eventually. That's not the way money works. Outside of that, the other interesting issue today in particular was bonds. And again, despite the fact that we have a market that's breaking out to all-time highs, you take a look at economic data, and we'll talk about some more of that today. About what the economic data is really saying. But, you know, the economic data is good. Earnings have been great. But nonetheless, despite all that, there's really not been any showing by bonds that, well, they're really buying into this rally. Nor are bonds really buying into the idea that, well, inflation and interest rates are about to take off. And this has been one of the big, the big fears of the market. Really, since 2013, I've written numerous articles about why the bond bull market is not dead. And since that time, we have remained below 3% on bonds. And in fact, every time bonds have rallied up to this 3% level, we've been avid buyers of bonds and adding those to portfolios. And we continue to do so. And here's a good point about today. The market has basically declined over the last 5 days. Today, the market rallies and bonds rally with it. Now, if there was truly a rotation from risk into or from safety back into risk, people saying, oh, this is the buying opportunity right here. Well, we should see bonds selling off pretty sharply, and that's simply not the case. Money is rotating into safety, particularly from international markets, as you know, those areas are lackluster in terms of performance. Interest rates are higher in the U.S., so that attracts capital flows. And of course, the strength of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy is also attracting foreign inflows as well. So that's keeping bonds suppressed. Remember, bonds are a place not only just for a trading opportunity for investors, but it's also where international countries, basically park their cash when they're wanting to sanitize trade and transactions with the U.S. So despite the fact that President Trump is up in arms about the trade deficit, which, by the way, just hit an all-time record last week, but is upset about these trade negotiations with China, basically money still flowing into the U.S. Treasury to sanitize those transactions and keep stability between currencies on a global basis somewhat regulated so that trade does not become too imbalanced, and that keeps the economies working. This is one of the big fears that we have with this whole trade situation that Donald Trump has cooked up in the office, and not saying that trade and trade negotiations aren't important, but you got to make sure that you really kind of understand what you're getting into. The whole point with tariffs and with trade is simply to negotiate a better deal. The problem is when you start trying to force transactions to occur through the use of tariff and higher taxes, that tends to have a negative adverse consequence to the U.S. Remember, tariffs are a tax on producers. They're also a tax on consumers that are having to eat those higher costs. There's an interesting point that was made today talking about Apple that, you know, well, if Apple just moved all their stuff back home, well, an Apple iPhone would only cost 20% more because of the tariffs. Well, the problem is now is there are a record number of individuals that are having to go into debt in order to buy an iPhone because they don't have the cash on hand to pay for it out of pocket. Now, you increase that cost by another 20%. The real risk to Apple is that there is a marginal breakpoint to where people opt for another cheaper option. They may really want the iPhone. Right? I really want a Lamborghini, but I'm not going to pay the cost of a Lamborghini because it's a cool car. Well, at some point, there's going to be a price point that consumers will opt for an Android phone or some other version of a phone because the cost or the breakpoint of buying an iPhone becomes simply too expensive. Remember, as we've always talked about here on the show, people buy payments, they don't buy products. You don't buy a house. You buy the monthly payment. You go look at the house. You go, wow, this is a beautiful house, crown molding, pool in the backyard. You know, already comes preconditioned with the dog. You know, the whole night, it's perfect. The thing you want. You don't say, well, you don't really say just how much is the house. Great, I'll buy it. You say, how much is the house? They go, it's $500,000. You say, well, how much is the payment? Because the payment is what allows you to afford the house. Same thing with a phone. Same thing with a car. Car notes are now at a record high for this cycle, over $500 a month for a car note. Rent is at an all-time high for consumers that are trying to find a place to live. So everything that we're buying is going up, and there is a point to where consumption begins to slow because of an inability to afford higher payments. Consumer credit today just hit another all-time record. So again, we continue to ramp up consumer credit. We're ramping this up at a time that real wages continue to really stagnate. Now, we did see a little bit of a tick up just in the last week on wage growth. But remember, while everybody's all excited about the tick up in wage growth, it was nominal. When we get the inflation number, we're going to find out that real wage growth, guess what? It's pretty much remained stagnant really over the course of the last several years. While the cost of living, whether it's from insurance to college tuition costs to housing to rent to car notes, have all gone up markedly more than wages have actually risen. So some of those things are very important in the longer term. Some of them are important in the shorter term. But as we were talking about a second ago, when we come back and look at the markets, again, we have to understand that in the very short term, the bullish sentiment is still very, very strong. So we have to pay homage to that. We have to honor that momentum that is currently in the markets. Now, where that ends, we don't know. But this is why we watch this very carefully. We talk about it here every day during our market wrap and how to allocate portfolios again. As we see this elevation continuing, that's going to be the area that we want to keep money allocated to, particularly as we roll into the last quarter of the year, right? October, November, December tend to be seasonally strong months for the market. Portfolio managers and others that have lagged this year are going to be trying to play catch up. That's going to push money into markets, and it's going to go into the favorite stocks, right? It's going to chase the stocks that performed the best this year. So the stocks to own going into the end of the year are not the laggards. The stocks going to the end of the year are going to be the ones that have already been the leaders and are leaders now, because money will chase performance. So keeping a watch on that, and of course, we are watching interest rates and we are watching the longer term trend. If we fail at this current support level and begin to go lower, we're going to have a different conversation. But right now, Volume is very light. The trend is positive. Supports are holding. And there is a lot of support in this uptrend right now that currently remains in place. So again, the bullish bias is to the upside. And when we come back after the break, we got a lot of other stuff to get into. Richard Rosso, certified financial planner here is also. I'm your host, Lance Roberts. You're listening to The Lance Roberts Show right here on Real Investment Advice. Be right back.
Get daily investment news you can use. Delivered at the speed of the internet. Sign up for Lance's newsletter now at LanceRobertsShow.com.
A new professional version of Real Investment Advice is coming in September, but you can subscribe now for free at RealInvestmentAdvice.com and click on the RIA Pro tab. You'll have access to Lance Roberts' proprietary stock and ETF portfolios, analysis, and all of the critical investment information you need in one place. RIA Pro, the professional version of Real Investment Advice. Subscribe now for free at realinvestmentadvice.com and click on the RIA Pro tab.
Lance Roberts returns Saturday mornings at 9, starting September 8th.
Policies should be fiscally conservative for the benefit of our economy.
Lance Roberts returns Saturday mornings at 9 on AM 700, The Voice of Texas.
And welcome back to the show. It is Monday here in the markets. And, of course, on Lance Roberts Show right here at RealInvestmentAdvice.com. Richard Rosso, certified financial planner in the studio today. Hi, Rich. What's up?
Hey, did you know that today's real average wage, that's, again, after accounting for inflation.
Accounting for inflation.
Same purchasing power as it did 40 years ago.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Pew Research. Did the research as of early August, showing that in 40 years, American paychecks may be bigger, but purchasing power has not budged.
Well, it's interesting because I run a chart that we produce every couple of months when we talk about real wage growth and these type of things that show the deficit between what people can buy based on their income and savings. So, right, we look at the savings rate and we look at what wages are and we say, okay, if we spend all that to support our standard of living, are we in a net positive or net negative deficit? And if we're in a deficit, we take a look at credit usage and say, well, how much is credit being used to make up for that
gap? That's a great chart.
Yeah.
The great, the makes up the gap in standard of living, and you show that.
Exactly. And right now, the average American, and it makes perfect sense because you talk to most people, right? They're using more and more credit card. It's about a $7,000 deficit a year just to keep up with the standard of living. That, they're not expanding their standard of living, right?
They're just keeping up.
They're just keeping up. And, of course, we keep using more and more of our credit. Again, the stat out today, you know, credit growth has now hit another all-time record. So there, you know, that's, we're going more and more into debt. Dave Ramsey has to love days like today because that means his business will prosper forever.
Not really. If nobody wants to pay it off, but I guess in a few years it will.
Yeah, but no, he'll, he does debt counseling, so he's got guaranteed customers for the next.
He absolutely does. You know, again, I'm not the biggest Dave Ramsey fan based on a couple of things he says, but the fact that he talks about living smaller. And within your means, you know, I mean, tried and true stuff that the people that buy into it and actually learn to pay off their debts, it's amazing to listen to those calls because they're exhilarated. They feel like they've lost about 1,000 pounds. You know, there's so much freedom in not having to use credit to make up your standard of living. And again, wage gains have gone largely, which you showed this too in charts, to the highest wage earners. So if you're in the top 10%, especially, obviously, if you've invested in markets and real estate over the last decade, you've done very, very well.
Well, and that's actually
so
a great
whatever
point.
This recession, whatever the Great Recession was, you've pretty much forgotten 90% of the population.
Well, and that's a great point because, you know, when we look at things like wage growth, we look at household disposable debt to income ratios. We look at, housing debt to income ratios. The problem with all those numbers is they are heavily skewed by those at the top 10% of the population. So you really have to go strip those out and look at, you know, because really, honestly, it's not even the top 10%. It's the top 1%. That really,
it really is. I've been being polite.
Yeah, the wage growth is so large for the top 1%, it skews the bottom 80% heavily to the upside.
I think what you're seeing since Trump, whatever the reason for it is, maybe more positive animal spirits and how much cash has, I mean, obviously most of the cash that's come over has gone into stock buybacks. I just think that you're starting to see more wage growth, maybe for that 10%, not just the 1%. Everybody's still lagging behind. It's funny. Wage growth is the very last thing to budge.
Right.
Because the money can go to so many other places, right? Employees are a liability in many cases. I mean, we need our people, and a lot of companies do, and we might cease wage growth for a greater percentage of the population, but as long as you have more technology. So I passed McDonald's.
Yep.
And they said, coming soon, right? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. The first thing they're featuring, they have like a poster up there, right, when you drive by, and it says they're going to have like some sort of concierge, like some sort of like server, like a waiter service, right?
Really?
But the first thing they feature, kiosks.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean,
and you know
so,
what the second thing they feature is? Honey barbecue wings.
Yeah, I saw that.
When did McDonald's get to the honey barbecue wing?
I don't know,
thing?
But I wanted to try those. I just got to see how they are. I don't know. I mean, I've seen the commercials. Yeah. So what I'm saying is we've had this increase in technology. You don't like to hear the U word, but we've lost the ability for unions to collective bargain effectively for mass number of people. Right.
Well, not only they lost the ability, there's recent legal precedent that has begun to weigh on collective bargaining issues as well with unions. But no, that's an interesting point you bring up about wages. And I thought and that dovetails into a comment that Donald Trump tweeted out today saying that, you know, the unemployment rate is now above, you know, economic growth for the first time in like 100 years, which A, is not true.
Right.
B, it's a very bad analysis considering that. You know, when you're at 3.9% unemployment and you're above the GDP growth rate, that's not a good thing. That means you've got very low economic growth.
Right.
But here's the point about this. Record low jobless claims, record high wages. Mm-hmm. Let's just say we have record high wages. Just bear with me for a second. Record low unemployment, record, you know, strong economic growth. These are not things that occur at the beginning of an economic cycle.
What's so counterintuitive. I have to tell people.
Marks,
go ahead and explain.
Yeah,
that,
this is what this is what happens at the end of the cycle. Wage growth expands when companies have run out of, as you said a second ago, when companies have run out of all their options. They've hired all the losers they can hire. They've suppressed wages as long as they can. They are literally down to the fact they've got to actually now hire people and pay them more to keep them at the job. That's what happens at the end of a cycle. You know, things are always best at the end of an economic cycle. And that's so. And here's how to invest around this. Bull markets end when everything is at its best. Bear markets end when everything is at its absolute worst. So think about 2009.
That's right.
We absolutely believe that nothing could get worse in the market in 2009, and that was the bottom of the bear market. So, you know, when you look around and people go, hey, man, this economy is ripping. You've got to invest in the market. You've got to get all your capital to work right now. Just remember, this is where things end. It's not where things begin. I'm not saying it's going to end tomorrow,
no.
But the point is that you're very late in the cycle.
You are, and I had to actually talk to some mutual friend of ours over the weekend and help her understand this because she was saying how great things are. And I said, well, this is usually a peak. When things start to get overheated and you have a Fed that's going to be very anxious to raise rates, this is usually the peak. Now, I don't know when we start to turn, but I think over the last 10 years, we've sort of been on low simmer as far as economic growth. Now, if we do start to pick up, that is the sign more of peak more than it is the beginning, when people are starting to feel very confident. So it might carry over through holiday. You know, you're going into it seasonally after September for the markets, but people are going to be looking to probably spend a lot during holiday season. I have a feeling it's going to be one of the bigger years.
Sure. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing you bring
on
up
credit.
Too because on credit. But you know, it's an interesting thing you bring up because
you know,
if
you
go
say
back to
in bed,
yeah.
We just have to say on credit for everything.
So if you go back to 2012
and
you look at the economic data that occurred in 2012, now it was never classified as a recession, but it was indeed an industrial recession.
Dip. Yes,
and,
there was.
And there was a consumer recession, but there was an industrial recession. Now, here's what's interesting is that going back to 2009, we've had a series of events that have bailed out the markets that have come at the most opportune of times. In 2012, Japan was hit by a major earthquake, tsunami, nuclear disaster. Godzilla was born and released at that point. And then that shut down manufacturing over there. And there was there was a real industrial slowdown here in the U.S. And then, of course, all that came back up online with this big rebuild that trenched us out of that and gave us some economic growth in 13 and 14. And then we had September of last year, we had three major hurricanes, two major wildfires. And so, yes, we're seeing some economic bump from those natural disasters that are coming through. We're spending billions, like 30, you know, tens of billions of dollars in rebuilding here in Houston where we live. We're still just passing a $2.5 billion bond
That's right.
Can get another $2.5 billion in matching dollars. That's $5 billion going into the Houston economy to rebuild homes. So all that's showing up in this economic data. So we're seeing this bump from all these natural disasters last year that are pulling through. And just at a time that we're going to potentially start to see that bump of those natural disasters roll off, Hurricane Florence is scheduled to hit basically the Carolinas and Virginia. It's supposed to be the worst natural disaster they've seen in decades.
No, I've seen that. See that.
Which is horrible. And look, I'm not, you know, I wish them the best. And it's horrible to say, hey, you know, this is going to be great for the economy. But my point is that, you know, here at a time where we're just about to see this stimulus roll off, you're about to get another natural disaster, you know, broken window fallacy type, you know, rebuilding of the economy. So
Mother Nature has a stimulus program.
I'm telling you. And it's been amazing that the timing of these events have occurred at just the right time to really keep this whole economic cycle kind of just churning along. You know, we're not creating great rates of economic growth. We're averaging 2.25%. But it's every time we start to slow down, we get this natural disaster bump. Extremely cold winters have been very beneficial. Collapsing oil prices have helped in some cases. So it's been interesting to watch.
Well, then you have that other cold front, or that other front that keeps that's going to interfere, and that's Hurricane Powell. Because as things start to pick up.
I thought he was talking about Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, well, not going there. Mr. Powell is going to continue to raise rates. We have a Fed meeting at the end of the month. I tell people always, when you go back in history, and I know you're a great market historian, and I'm just fascinated by market history and traders, higher interest rates always have the ability to blow it. It just has the ability to slow down activity, increase borrowing costs, and just take the wind. I mean, Fed officials will tell you it is a break on economic activity. So I always compare it to breaking on thin ice, but they don't know how they have fat feet. So they're gonna make you slide. It's very rare that the Fed is gonna navigate this beautifully.
They've never navigated it beautifully.
Right.
So, you know, I've got a chart I just published last week that shows every rate hiking cycle ends in a recession or some type of crisis because the problem is the Fed is acting on data that's occurring in arrears. Let's talk about 2007 real quick.
Okay.
December of 2007, everybody believed the economy was fine.
Yes.
Okay. Everything was perfect.
Yep.
Goldilocks economy. Fed's hiking interest rates, absolutely nothing to worry about. And I wrote an article in December of 2007 said, we are in or about to be in the biggest recession since the Great Depression.
I even remember that.
In 2008, the NBR comes out and says, oh, the recession started a year earlier in December of 2007. Now, we didn't know that for an entire year. The Fed didn't know it for an entire year until after the 2008 financial crisis. And because they operate on the data today, but the problem is economic data is revised in arrears. After the fact, we come back and revise the data and say, oh, yeah. Sorry, that economy really slowed down a lot more than we thought a year ago. And had they would have known that, they would have stopped raising rates when they did. But to your point, and you're exactly right, the Fed hikes rates until something breaks, and that's when they stop. When we come back from the break, I want to pick up something Ray Dalio said to this point today as well. Ray Dalio, the CEO of Bridgewater, came out with an interesting topic talking about the big debt cycles that we go through. They go through six stages. And when we come back, I'll get you to identify which stage we're in.
Richard. Okay.
All right. Be right back after the break. I'm your host, Lance Roberts. RealInvestmentAdvice.com is the website. And be sure and check out our new Real Investment Advice Pro tab. It's on the website now. You can sign up for a two-week free trial, get our portfolios and more. It's all at the website, RealInvestmentAdvice.com. I'll be right back.
Lance Roberts Blog. It's required reading for the informed investor. Catch it today on LanceRobertsShow.com.
And now, another page from the Real Investment Advisor's Investing Manifesto. Bulls win in bull markets. Bears win in bear markets. Eagles soar above and take advantage of opportunity. Let us help you soar as you reach your financial goals with Clarity Financial. Neither bull nor bear. Clarity Financial. 281-501-1791. Or online at realinvestmentadvice.com.
So they're just showing a headline up here on Fox News a second ago. talking about McMaster, and they're showing a picture of the hurricane blowing into South Carolina. So I'm like, what, they just renamed the hurricane McMaster? So we'll see. This is not, like I said, this is going to be interesting to watch this week. Keep a watch on South Carolina, Virginia. They're in for a big blow. This hurricane's a Category 4 and is expected to be hurricane Category 5 before it hits. So
I know many people in Texas and in Houston are saying big prayers for these individuals of what we've gone through.
I know. Look, so. I grew up with Carla. I went through Alicia. In fact, I was packing my car in the middle of Hurricane Alicia to drive to go to college. And when Alicia was born, my dad's like, what are you doing? It's like, I'm leaving town.
He's like,
there's like a hurricane, son. It's okay. I'm out of here. But yeah, so I mean, when you've been through hurricanes, it is my house when I was growing up, I lived in Lake Jackson, which is about an hour south of Houston. And our house was flooded twice. And in fact, when after the house flooded the first time, my dad ripped out all the carpet, tiled the whole house so that if it flooded, ever flooded again, we just mop it out.
Mop it, yeah.
And which it did. It flooded two more times after that. But, you know, once you go through these things, you have a real – unless you've ever been – if you've ever had your house flooded and you've lost all your stuff, you don't really have an appreciation for just how trying – going through a hurricane or something like that, or flood, or whatever it really is. It's really much worse than you can imagine. So to your point, Richard, we absolutely, you know, thoughts and prayers out to all those in California, South Carolina, and Virginia.
I'm sure many people in Texas, if there's a, God forbid, any disaster there, they'll be the first to help.
Oh yeah, you know,
that's very generous.
Yeah, when we had Hervey here, it was amazing. People all around the country.
Yeah, really, just.
All around the country, people were lining up. They were driving here from Louisiana and other states to help out.
Not California, though. I don't think
didn't see that. Rex Nutting wrote a pretty nasty article about Houston and Hurricane Harvey, believe it or not, in the middle of it. Yeah. So said we deserved it because we elected.
I remember this.
Houston deserved Hurricane Harvey because we elected Trump. So that was his. Not that this political commentary one way or the other, but just, you know, that's not the time.
No.
That's all you need to say.
Yeah, that's not the time.
All you need to say.
So Ray Dalio.
Rex Nutting.
Rex Nutting.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so just for the break, we're talking about economic cycles and, you know, why this is important. And of course, Ray Dalio, who's the CEO of Bridgewater, came out with a very interesting article talking about, and it really came out of his book as well that he wrote. He says, all big debt cycles go through six stages, which I describe and explain how to navigate. He says the early part of the cycle, the bubble, the top, the depression, the beautiful deleveraging, and the pushing through a string of normalization. What's interesting is that we had the recovery, you know, in early 2009. But the thing that we never allowed to happen
was the beautiful deleveraging.
Exactly.
And I always thought that was going to happen. Because I looked at what happened after the depression. Right. And I figured we were going to get some form of this deleverage. It just never did happen.
Well, and again, why would it? You had Federal Reserve coming in. We were bailing out homeowners through HAMP and HARP and TARP.
Unorthodox and monetary policy.
Exactly.
Right? Quantitative easing that people may have forgotten about. So we never hit that stage. Mm-hmm. As much as he wrote about that in anticipation that this is what we should see, and he's written so many pieces during the Great Recession about the deleveraging, or beautiful deleveraging, as they called it. And I'm like, this makes perfect sense. Yet it never occurred.
Right. Well, it's interesting because you take a look at all the people that went through HARP and HAMP and they refied their home. Here was the biggest problem with that is that, look, we used to care about bankruptcy in this country. You file for bankruptcy, you were out of the credit market for 10 years. You tried to go get a mortgage or whatever. If you had a bankruptcy on your credit, you were locked out of getting a loan for 10 years because you were a credit risk. You know, after the financial crisis, we no longer care about a bankruptcy. Mm-mm. And it's like, oh, you file bankruptcy during financial? Who cares, right? We'll give you credit. And in fact, we're more than happy to extend you credit. But here's
the point. But become more acceptable.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You know, and so because in the hurry to extend credit to, you know, create opportunity and create growth, you know, we have set aside normal lending standards that keep us out of financial trouble long term. Mm-hmm. And the problem with what happened in the financial crisis was that people that needed to default, in other words, they bought a house they couldn't afford. They were in some part of the country like Chicago or Detroit, somewhere else that had no job opportunities, et cetera. They needed to be able to default on their house and then move somewhere else. Look, we gave up caring about bankruptcies anyway, but what we did was we wound up refinancing these people into houses they couldn't afford through HAMP and HARP, and they wound up redefaulting all over again. Mm-hmm. And then they were locked into their house. They couldn't. They had what's called a lack of mobility. They couldn't move somewhere to where there was work. So they were locked in areas of low job growth or low wage growth in a house they couldn't afford. So it just simply got worse and worse over time. And to your point, we never, through all these other programs, whether it's quantitative easing or banks bailing people out or banks ignoring the fact that houses were in default and just allowing people to live in them without payments, we never went through that deleveraging process, which impacted the ability for the economy to really gain good solid footing mm-hmm. for true strong economic growth. And we should be, and we allowed the major banks to default. If we had allowed bankruptcies to happen, we would be growing organically at 4 or 5% now instead of 2.
I think at the time it was just very difficult because you, and this is, goes back to the great, one of the greatest economists who doesn't get enough credit, Hyman Minsky, that talked about his Minsky moment, where it doesn't take much to topple an entire system. And I don't think we realized, at least I was surprised, how quickly our so-called solid or stable system can unravel. Mm-hmm. So, but to your point, we should have allowed some form of unraveling to occur, and we didn't. We just, you know, again, we did this with banks too, didn't we? We did mm-hmm. this across the entire economy. We've bailed out. For the most part, I mean, when it comes to banks, I understand there's been stress tests and all that, but aren't they still sitting on what's going on with accounting, for example?
Yeah.
And nothing's right. really changed. I mean, it's just supposedly time would heal all this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
all these broken foundations. It's like you ignore it long enough. Time eventually takes care of things, I guess.
Right. Well, you know, we changed accounting rules. We got right. rid of FASB Rule 157, which, mm-hmm. you know, got rid of mark-to-market accounting. So people go, well, you know, banks are all, you know, we've passed these stress tests. The banks are financially healthy. But really, when you dig down into them, because of the fact we're not requiring mark-to-market accounting, because of the leverage that's in banks, inside of banks, et cetera, they're not as healthy as they seem on the surface. You know, and the one fact is that, you know, as we look at the consumer credit cycle, right, we're back to that point about extending credit to people that, well, here, I'll give you a couple of good examples. We've got Fannie Mae now extending 3% down mortgages to
That's
individuals
right.
with no down payments.
Just at the time when housing prices are peaking and so forth, we're just going ahead and start this all over again, right?
Right. And then, of course, what could possibly go wrong now that retail investors can now sell credit default swaps through an ETF? What could possibly happen when you start bundling a credit default swap, which is a derivative of a derivative? Remember, credit default swaps are what basically blew up the market for the most part back in 2008 when the counterparty trade basically evaporated because of Lehman. So what could possibly go wrong if you start selling credit default swaps through a stable instrument like an ETF? You know, the issues of where we're extracting the risk in the markets and repositioning the risk trade in the market is mm-hmm. is always the unknown consequence to all this, is that we pile into these quote-unquote passive investments. They sound great until the liquidation occurs. And then once the liquidation occurs, the run for the exit creates a liquidity crisis that all of a sudden you can't get out of the positions you own quick enough.
Well,
so
this is what Minsky would talk about, is you take on more risk. Look at what you just said about mm-hmm. Fannie Mae, right? You take on more risk and you keep expanding until that one last move that causes the domino effect. So you're in this process of rebuilding all of this again with the complacency and what we see. For many people, the Great Recession is still very fresh. It was great, mm-hmm. some great articles in the Wall Street Journal, but for most, there was an article by Ken Fisher today or in USA Today. He's pretty much like, oh, yeah, see, markets come back, no problem, 10 years later. I mean, again, you're in that process. Now, quick question for you, or maybe not. Markets are very counterintuitive. Just when you think things are perfect, mm-hmm. markets maybe not perform perfectly because they're always looking ahead.
Mm-hmm.
What signs would we have that, for example, that all this great economic news is not impressing the markets anymore? What would we see?
I think you would already say you see that. I mean, okay. basically, you know, you take a look at where we are in the markets. We've got great economic news, mm-hmm. but the markets are where they were back in January.
Yes.
So we've spent an entire 6 months of this year virtually going nowhere on the back of record earnings growth, great economic news, and, you know, expectations that continue to be elevated. So I think that tells you a lot that the market's already beginning to kind of price in some assumptions that things are getting potentially as good as they can get But when we come back, I want to wrap up talking about the illusion of control. I have an article out on the website today, realinvestmentadvice.com, called The Human Brain and the Money Game. We'll talk about that because it actually relates exactly to what Richard and I are talking about right now, is the matching up of what happens in the short term versus what happens in the long term of the market and how you react to it. So don't go away. We'll come back with that, wrap up the show, Real Investment Advice. I'm your host, Lance Roberts, for the Lance Roberts Show right here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Don't go away.
Want a longer talk with Lance about your money? Request a personal one-on-one at LanceRobertsShow.com.
A new professional version of Real Investment Advice is coming in September, but you can subscribe now for free at realinvestmentadvice.com and click on the RIA Pro tab. You'll have access to Lance Roberts' proprietary stock and ETF portfolios, analysis, and all of the critical investment information you need in one place. RIA Pro, the professional version of Real Investment Advice. Subscribe now for free at realinvestmentadvice.com and click on the RIA Pro tab.
And Rich, you got a seminar coming up here this week.
We do, on Wednesday evening, September 12th at 6:30 here at our office, 11750 Katy Freeway. Social Security, one of the most complex, difficult, or confusing social programs. We want to help you make the best of it, so Danny Ratliff and I are going to help you understand basic claiming strategies and how to get the most out of Social Security and debunk some of the myths. So if you would like to attend, again, don't miss this. This is an interactive workshop. We won't take a lot of your time. Seating is limited here at Clarity. So if you go to Real Investment Advice, look at the seminar tab, you'll see an area to sign up right from there. Or you can give us a call at 281-501-1791. And I'm excited about all the different workshops we're setting up for this year, the end of this year, and next year.
Yeah, we got some webinars coming up. Mm-hmm. We've got all kinds of cool stuff. So, of course, you can find all about that on the website, as always, realinvestmentadvice.com. We always have stuff listed under the events tab. Like I said, we'll have webinars coming up as well for you to participate in. So if you're not in the Houston area, we have a lot of listeners from around the country. Yep. So we'll have stuff for you as well.
Absolutely.
Keep you up to date. Article on the website today called The Human Brain and the Money Game. It was an article actually written by Jason Zweig back in 2003 that was forwarded to me by John Camarianos in our office last week. And Jason had updated the article in October of last year, but it was such a good piece that as I read it, it brought to light a lot of the issues that we talked about here on the show, talking about, you know, how the markets today have been transformed from what used to be an investing program where we invested capital to grow it over time. And look, I know everybody thinks that's what they're doing. But the reality is that, you know, back in the day, so to speak, you know, when Rich and I were growing up, that, you know, there were people had a stockbroker who actually worked for a living
and owned individual stocks.
And it took 3 or 4 days by the time the company GA would announce earnings. Mm-hmm. By the time it got all the way down the food chain to the broker to you, it was 3 or 4 days. And the announcement, oh, so Rich, GE missed, you know, earnings by a penny, but the outlook still looks good. Okay, great. So, well, let's go buy some more, right? Today, they announced by a penny, and of course, that since the world has become a giant video game now with flashing lights and red and green and arrows up and down and money won and lost in just a blink of an eye, you know, we've gotten this release of this dopamine effect, so we have to react, you know, so if our stock's going up, we feel great, so we want to go buy some more. If stock's going down, we just turn the machine off, we don't even look at it because it doesn't make us feel good, and we've gotten detached from investing for the long term. And a lot of people go, well, I'm a long-term investor. You're not anymore.
Not,
the average
not
holding
anymore.
Time for stocks is down to 3 to 4 months from used to be 6 years on average.
We buy at price A, we hope to sell at price Z. That's all we care about. And we look at it from day to day. So it's become this legalized casino.
Right.
And our emotions are out of control.
But here's what's interesting. You just said the important thing, right? We buy it at price A, we want to sell it at price B, but then yet we're told by the media every day to buy it but never sell it.
No, it's selling is a four-letter word. Sell is a four-letter word for sure.
Right.
When it comes to financial media.
Which, when you're investing, there's two halves of the investing cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You have to buy something, but in order to realize your opportunity, you have to sell it to realize your gain.
The harvest. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's great. One thing that Jason wrote is online trading firms went further. This is from Jason. Blowing the traditional brokerage model to bits with no physical branch offices, no in-house research, no investment banking, no brokers, they had one thing to offer their customers, the ability to trade at will without the counterweight of any second opinion or expert advice. Once that degree of freedom might have frightened investors, but the new internet brokerages cleverly fostered what psychologists call the illusion of control. And I think that's such a good point, because as investors, we think that we're actually in control of the investments. Let me tell you who's in control of an investment: Warren Buffett. When Warren Buffett invests in a stock, he can actually direct the board of directors to make decisions about the company. He can also link, he can buy See's Candies, and then he can go buy, make an investment in Coke, and then all of a sudden have See's Candies selling their products through Coke, right? He can merge his businesses. He has a lot of opportunities through the company he owns through his investments, because he can control a stake in the investment. He can help, he can direct board of directors. He can change directions of companies. That is control over an investment. The illusion of control, me, Richard, you, the illusion of control that we have is that we actually are buying a stock and think that our stock ownership represents something other than an ethereal piece of digital paper that we own it at one price. And the only thing we have to gain from that is to sell it at another price. That's the only control we have. And any other illusion outside of that is simply that.
But you have to control your emotions as to when maybe a price goes against you or you actually do well. Because then if it goes up, then you're a maven. You've got incredible skill. If it goes down, it's not my fault. I'm a victim of circumstance. I mean, your emotions, especially I think at peaks or valleys or troughs, is the worst. So we're going to start to see this fear of missing out. I'm already starting to hear the elevator talk about the stock market. That troubles me when it comes to emotion. People are going to start to get carried away.
Well, and again, we've created the advent of this as well. So it started out with E-Trade and Schwab, and now we've gotten down to programs like Robinhood and Stash, where you can stock trade right there on your phone for free. You know, just buy these shares and sell them, and you know, buy them and sell them. And it's interesting because a recent poll showed, and of course, a lot of millennials are using things like Robinhood and Stash to trade stocks in their portfolio, and they took a poll of the users of these apps last year, at the end of the year. And of course, the market was up last year. And all these users vastly underperformed the S&P 500 because they were buying stocks that were underperforming, stocks that were out of favor, stocks that were going down. So they thought they'd try to buy them on the way down, they come back up. And of course, those right there are three of your biggest errors in investing, is to dollar cost average down into a losing stock. You never buy a loser. Holding on to things that you hope are going to come back, and buying falling knives. You know, those are three errors that investors regularly make in investing money. So, and what happens is these apps have now, like you said a second ago, we've turned Wall Street into this casino, so to speak, this video game of red and green, buy and sell, and hopefully somehow we're going to wind up making a lot of money. But statistics regularly show that because of all of our emotional biases, whether it's hurting or recency bias or a whole variety of others. And I cover all these emotional biases in our article, which is on the website. It's called The Human Brain and the Money Game. It's on the website now. But the two biggest factors that deride outcomes of investing is lack of capital and psychological behaviors. And it's not investing for most people. It's not managing their money. It's the psychology. They buy high and sell low, and they don't have capital to invest when they should be investing. So, you know, so this is why we take a look at statistics. 401k plans, $29,000 for the average 401k plan, average household, $500 in the bank. How can you invest when you have no savings in the bank?
Well, what you're hoping is that, hey, I might hit the big one. Look how many people decided on cryptocurrencies, that they were going to go ahead and mortgage the farm. And
right.
Put most of their money into Bitcoin, because that was going to be the new paradigm.
And what happened that one?
Disastrous. But there were people that did follow rules and first bought into cryptos on Coinbase, and guess what? And we talked, and I talked to them quite a bit. They had a sell discipline.
Right.
They would sell and keep selling, and they would take profits. They understood what they were doing was speculating. They didn't look at it as some new paradigm. They looked at it as to what it was.
Right.
It was a gamble, and if I win, I'm taking chips off the table. And those are the people that really have prospered.
And you know what? Look, you can enter to the markets in one of two manners.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you recognize what you are going in, you're fine.
If you know yourself that way.
I'm going in and I'm going to day trade the market. I'm going to be a speculator. I'm going to buy something here. I'm going to sell it here. I'm going to do it in 20 minutes.
Yep.
That's great. Know what you are. The biggest fallacy for most people is they enter the market going, oh, I'm a long-term investor. I'm going to listen to this guy that's promoting buy and hold investing philosophy. I'm going to buy it. And then as soon as I lose 30% of my money, I'm out. Because they can't stand the pain
anymore. Well, if it goes up, I'm a buy and hold.
Right. But
if it's going down, I'm buying cold, man. I'm up. I'm frozen. I'm out of there.
Know what you are when you're going in to invest.
Know thyself.
Know thyself. That's such a great point. Mm. Know thyself. And know what you're doing when you're investing and follow the rules. Look, go to our website today. Our article is out called The Money Brain, The Human Game. And if you're an advisor listening to the show right now, thank you for joining us. Also read the article because we have strategies at the bottom of the article for advisors because it's our job to act as the psychologist and the behavioralist for our clients. That's on the website now, The Money Game, The Human Brain at realinvestmentadvice.com. I'm your host, Lance Roberts. Richard Rosso, certified financial planner. See you tomorrow at 3 o'clock for the next edition of The Lance Roberts Show right here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Always Sunday in the rich man's world. It's a rich man's world.